Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, cultural enrichment, and all-inclusive fares. Discover more at Viking.com.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome, I'm Paul Gigault, the opinion editor of the Wall Street Journal, and today we have a special edition of Potomac Watch with my guest, David McCormick. He's a graduate of West Point, veteran of Desert Storm in Iraq, former CEO of the investment firm Bridgewater Associates, and most recently, a Republican Senate candidate in Pennsylvania. He's also the author of a new book, Superpower in Peril, A Battle Plan to Renew America. Welcome, David. Nice to have you with us.
Paul, thanks for having me.
All right. Let's talk about it in your book and politics and so on. But first, you're a veteran of Wall Street. I want you to get your take on what you think is happening here with this little financial panic we've been having, the failure of two mid-sized banks. How extensive is this problem?
Well, I think the problem is quite extensive in the sense that the context for this is more than a decade of excess in spending. That was accelerated dramatically under Joe Biden with more than $10 trillion of incremental spending and 40% increase in discretionary spending, but also a decade of excess in the sense of extreme low interest rates. And that has created an environment where investors have allocated capital as if it were risk-free. And of course, it led to inflation. And so the irony is that what the catalyst for this was the Federal Reserve responding to the inflation that it created or helped create with a significant rise in interest rates, which of course had the secondary effect of creating an asset liability mismatch in many banks, but in particular in this terribly, terribly managed bank, the Silicon Valley Bank. And so this is an indicator of, I think, more challenging things to come. And it's an example of where the government's, in some ways, its response to the last crisis planted the seeds for what lies before us.
Right. With a decade or more of near zero interest rates, and people said, geez, I got to go out and find yield so I can get something other than zero on my money. And then they took risks that are now coming home true. So what do you make of the Biden administration's response guaranteeing even uninsured deposits above 250,000 at the banks and this new Fed facility?
Yeah, I'd say on that a couple things. I think it's evident that in the case of Silicon Valley Bank, you had a terribly managed bank, but I think you also need to turn an eye towards the regulators. And in this case, the San Francisco Fed, which should have had a handle on this. What happened is so obvious. That was a risk. And then particularly the risk at Silicon Valley Bank was poorly managed. Their deposits were highly, highly concentrated. The government's response, I'm very concerned about on a couple different levels. Unfortunately, they couldn't sell the bank over the weekend, but it's great that they blew out management. It's good that the creditors will pay a price. The equity has been taken to zero. But the fact that they've insured the depositors, in essence, bailing out the uninsured depositors, I think is very problematic on two levels. The first, if you're the landscaper who was a creditor, you just got wiped out.
Right.
So you're $15,000, you're not going to get paid. And yet the rich venture capital guy who lives down the road got 100% full money on their deposits. That's inherently seems unfair. The second thing is, of course, the moral hazard. So we've now set a precedent that uninsured deposits can be protected. And there's $18 trillion of deposits in our U.S. banking system. $8 trillion of them or so are uninsured. So does that mean we now have essentially made a commitment to insure that other $8 trillion? It seems so. Time will tell the consequences of that, but my guess is we'll live to regret it.
Yeah, that strikes me as exactly right. And the live to regret it in a couple of senses. One, you talk about the potential taxpayer risk here, but also the message it sends to bankers and depositors about due diligence and risk-taking. You think you're going to get rescued, you just take more risks.
That's right. And the idea of this isn't a bailout and all of that, and there's no taxpayer money, of course, is a semantic jujitsu move on behalf of Treasury Secretary Yellen, which isn't in line with reality. And certainly those venture capital investors who were lobbying all weekend, the Democrats in Washington, they feel like they got bailed out. And I think they're right.
Yeah, they're right. All right. All right. Let's turn to your book, Superpower in Peril, A Battle Plan to Renew America. So having just completed a Senate campaign, you lost narrowly 900 votes, I guess, something like that in the Republican primary. Why write a book? What's your thinking here?
Well, the book came before the Senate campaign.
Oh, it did.
So
okay.
I had started the book in 2020 and sold the idea. And it was because I really did feel like the country was headed in the wrong direction. I had written a couple articles and I proposed the book to the publisher and then started writing it because I thought that we needed a plan that really addressed the underlying root causes of our decline. I thought the fact that we were in decline was evident and that the path for getting out of decline was less so. And so my thesis here was that decline's not inevitable, but neither is renewal. It depends on what we do. And this book is the What We Do book, which essentially argues for educating our people, confronting China, and securing America. And there's an agenda, a policy agenda that goes along with that. And then I decided to run for the Senate for the same motivation, because I felt like things were headed in the wrong direction. Afghanistan was the catalyst for me. So I put the book aside for a better part of a year and then came back to it after I lost the campaign. And, that was helpful because the book in a big picture way didn't change, but there's so much more richness in the book because of the people I met on the campaign trail that really reinforced the ideas that I was trying to put forward in Superpower in Peril.
When you campaigned, did you find that the people you talked to, Pennsylvania, big state, a lot of variety, a lot of different people, wealthy, not wealthy, working class folks, did you find that they share your view that the United States is in trouble?
Yes, absolutely. I think there's a belief. In fact, polling shows that 80% of Americans think the country's headed in the wrong direction. In economic terms, historic debt levels of $31 trillion, inflation at a 40-year high, real income basically flat for many Americans for the last two decades, but also in a national security sense. I think there's a growing recognition we're being challenged by China for global leadership, and it's a techno-authoritarian state, which is going to be a real challenge for us to overcome. I think it's very doable, but we're going to need to do that. And then I think there's also a recognition that people have trouble describing it, but a spiritual decay. Essentially, the hijacking of our institutions by a progressive ideology, wokeness, whatever you want to call it, which is undermining some very basic concepts of what makes America exceptional. And so there's definitely that sentiment. But the thing I found on the campaign trail, Paul, which the book now conveys, hopefully even more convincingly, is that people were so angry. And some of those are people that are well-to-do in the suburbs, but many of them are rural Americans, and they basically feel like the last 20 years has not been good for them. They feel like the promise of America has left them behind and that elites in Washington and New York have looked past them, looked past their interests, been focused on themselves. And in my opinion, and the book tries to convey this, they're right. So the anger has good reason behind it. And so what this book tries to do is put forward a policy agenda that addresses a broader set of Americans and lays the groundwork for renewal at home, but also strength abroad. And it does that in a way that will be substantively better for America, but it also does so in a way that I think builds the necessary coalition for Republicans to win elections. Because in essence here, what I'm saying is we need good ideas, but we also need candidates who can win elections and put those ideas forward. And to do that, we need to appeal to a broader set of Americans than we have. Republicans have been losing elections for a while now, and there's good reason for it because we haven't done the things necessary to win, which is to largely look forward.
All right, let's dig into at least a couple of areas you write about, maybe elaborate a bit. One is you stress the need for talent, developing talent, American talent, human capital in essence, getting the most out of everyone in the country, the best they have to give. And you talk about reforming U.S. education, but I'm a little older than you, and I remember we've been talking about education reform at least since the Nation at Risk report came out in the early 1980s, and we have made a lot of progress, frankly. So, what do you want us to do differently than we've been doing?
It may be the hope of triumph over reason here, I guess, is your point, but I think we're at a different point in the following sense. I think there may be the underlying catalyst for really making change because we're declining in terms of the quality of our kids, their education, math, science, and engineering relative to the rest of the world. We're like 18th among developing countries. We continue to fall down the cliff here. But second, COVID may have been a blessing in this respect. COVID gave parents an ability to look much more closely at what's happening in the schools, the curriculum that's being taught around American history, the quality of the education and the teachers, the sexual agenda that's being introduced in elementary schools in terms of who's talking to children about issues regarding sex and gender and so forth. Parents saw that up close and personal, and it's created a movement, and you've seen the ups and downs of this movement, but I think there's real power behind it. We see that playing out in states like Virginia with Glenn Youngkin, like in Arkansas with Sarah Huckabee, And so I think we may be on the precipice of a tipping point here of potential change. And the key, of course, is underlying structural change, choice, having a children and parents have the capacity and the ability to take their students to the schools that are going to best serve their needs. And so that's the hope. And this moment allows for, I think, a level of political pressure and realization that hasn't happened before.
So it's choice in the goal in service of changing school governance. So it isn't dominated right now by your local district administrator who's accountable largely to the teachers' unions because, you know, parents are busy, obviously. They've got lives, they've got work and so on, they've got families. They can't pay attention to the policies, of any given school. And if you can't change the governance, you can't change the school.
100%. And there's lots of ways to change the governance. Part of it is the teacher, and this I saw this across Pennsylvania, but parents running for school boards and really bringing a change agenda. But obviously, at the core of this is going to be breaking the back of the teachers' unions. And that's a necessary part of this. And, you know, I come from a family of teachers, and I appreciate the incredible role they play, but they're in a system now which ultimately undermines their capacity to do their jobs well. In the book, I outline the fact that spending for education has increased at a certain percentage, but that 70% of that growth is in administration and principals and everything else.
Not, right, exactly.
This is a monopoly that's not sustainable. And it's now, I think, a time to take that fight at multiple levels. And that's what needs to happen. There's another thing that needs to happen in terms of education, which is, I highlight, which is skilled workforce. You know, in Pennsylvania, I grew up in a town where the dream was to go to college. And every kid had to go to college. That was the hope. Only 3 or 4 kids actually did go to college, but that was the dream. We need to rethink that a bit because we actually have huge opportunities for skilling our workforce in ways that conform to the needs of our current economy. And I saw this on the campaign trail in Pennsylvania. Manufacturers, machine shops, high-end chemical companies, they couldn't grow in part because they couldn't get skilled workers. The fracking industry is a huge regulatory burden, but they also have a skilled labor problem. They had to import folks from Oklahoma and Texas to work on the rigs. And so taking a national level focus on this and thinking about Pell Grants and veterans benefits and community colleges and corporate public partnerships to educate these kids, that's going to be a big part of creating the American dream for a whole new set of Americans who aren't going to go to a 4-year college and have that make a huge difference, but could have very productive, high quality income and high quality middle class lives if they pursue that path.
Yeah, very interesting. And of course, I think very important. All right, we're going to take a break. And when we come back, we'll have more with David McCormick on politics and policy.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive, with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.
Don't forget, you can reach the latest episode of Potomac Watch anytime. Just ask your smart speaker, play the Opinion Potomac Watch podcast. That is, play the Opinion Potomac Watch podcast.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
And we're back here with David McCormick, author of the book, Superpower in Peril, A Battle Plan to Renew America. Let's talk a little bit about another priority you have, which is you say we need to invest in technology. We have to win the technology race. I think you're clearly talking about national competitors, especially China. And if I detect in your book, you refer sometimes to the CHIPS Act, passed last year, provided a couple of $100 billion to Intel and other semiconductor makers. And it's a form of industrial policy, I think maybe the most overt implementation of industrial policy we've had in many decades. But you probably saw the Secretary of Commerce, Gina Raimondo, just imposed requirements on the companies that are getting this money that don't amount to industrial policy, they amount to social policy. Now, they must provide childcare, union worker labor for contractors, diversity rules. And if you have excess profits, as defined by, I guess, the politicians, you have to return them to the government. Now, my problem here is that this is what almost always happens with this kind of industrial policy. It becomes politically corrupted. What do you think of these Biden rules, and what do you do about it?
To start with, and this is something I've thought a lot about, because the reality is, to start, Paul, we are losing our edge. in technology. We're losing our edge. You know, Bob Lighthizer, 2017, released a report, the top 20 technologies at the intersection of economics and national security. China was in the lead in 10. We were in the lead in 10. A couple of weeks ago in the Wall Street Journal, which I'm sure you saw, was the report of a Australian think tank.
Right. Saw it.
44 technologies, 37 of them, China in the lead. So we are losing this battle. And two things can be true at the same time. China's economic model is not sustainable. It has to cave in on itself at some point. But in the interim, and that may be many, many years down the road, they are gaining leads because of the model they put forth. And in particular, the subsidization of key technologies, artificial intelligence and microchip and so forth. So we need a national strategy to deal with that. And it can't be a China model. And it can't be what the Democrats have proposed is industrial policy. There's got to be a market-based approach to ensuring through tax incentives and through potential government capital, which can take first loss and draw private capital into key sectors, not companies, to ensure that America is competing in those areas adequately. We also need to double down on basic R&D. Now, that's a controversial notion. And I take that on because the risk is what you say, which is you have industrial policy where the Democrats are making it a social experiment as opposed to driving capital through market forces into a sector that needs it. So I lay out a set of principles for how to ensure that the government's role is giving, sort of creating guidelines to draw capital into the areas that are of greatest strategic advantage. And I wrestle with that in the book. And there's a section which you may have seen, which says, what would Milton Friedman say? And I try try to take that on. And I think Milton would have questions about what I propose, and maybe you do as well. But my response to that was, but we're losing. And so in this environment, we have to find a way to get the capital to the areas we need and have market forces drive continued innovation. The book tries to lay out a path to do that, that guards against crony capitalism and guards against the government picking winners and losers in some of the many ways we've seen policy distorted in the past.
Just very difficult to do is when the government strays from basic research. I think you can do basic research very well. You know, there's the DARPA unit of the Pentagon, which is just seed money for high-tech projects and has done that very well and has had not only military uses, but also civilian commercial spinoffs of some significance. You know that some of our Energy Department labs do a lot of good work on research. The problem is when you get into this level of giving earmarks. I remember going into a Bush administration official in the White House, and they were pushing the renewable energy investment. And they said, I got a story for you, Paul. We're just on the cusp of this cellulosic ethanol taking off, but almost all of the money is earmarked by Congress. And of course, here we are now, almost 15, 16 years later, cellulosic ethanol is nowhere.
There's a long line of such failed experiments. I 100% agree with you.
Yeah, so it's a very difficult thing to do. But I agree with you that there's a problem here on we have to address in falling behind on technology. All right, David goes into an awful lot of detail in his book, Superpower in Peril, A Battle Plan to Renew America. And you can go into the details. They're not too wonky. He lays it out in ways that you don't have to be a policy wonk to appreciate. But let's talk a little bit about politics and what you learned in your Pennsylvania campaign about what it takes, you know, kind of lessons about politics and what it takes for a Republican to win in Pennsylvania, where you've got to win in the moderate suburban collar counties around Philly, but you also got to appeal to Trump voters in mid-state and in the West.
I mean, first of all, what a great life experience. When you wind up as a plebe at West Point, one of your mandatory classes in year one is boxing. And there was this old boxing coach named Herb Creighton, and he taught plebe boxing, and you walked in and he was kind of like Mickey and Rocky, and he'd say, can't win unless you get punched in the face. And that's what politics is, right? You got to be able to jump in the ring and be prepared to get punched in the face. And that's what it was. You jump in and you're immediately in this mixer of people coming at you in all sorts of different directions. But it was an incredible privilege. And when we decided to do it, my wife and I thought hard about it, prayed on it. We thought we were called to serve because we had something to offer. And we had a calculus in our mind, which is we thought that we had to appeal to those core movement conservatives, or many of them Trump voters, in rural Pennsylvania. And the fact that I grew up there and ran a campaign that was aligned with many of President Trump's policies would put me in good stead there, but it would be a tough fight. But we also, as you say, we needed to win the collar counties outside of Philadelphia. And I thought my business experience and my ability to great jobs in Pittsburgh and so forth would have been a real appeal. We thought we needed to run in a way that would have, we didn't think President Trump necessarily had to endorse me, but have him attack me would be a problem because he could direct a significant number of voters. We thought we had to run in a way that could appeal to independents and conservative Democrats. You know, you have to run in a way that for us was consistent with our values and where we could look in the mirror and say, we believe everything we're running on. And that's the challenge of running in Pennsylvania. But I think that's the challenge nationally today. And it was an incredible experience. We lost, as you said, by 900 votes of 1.4 million passed. And my big takeaway is three things, which I think apply nationally, maybe four things. First, we have to fix some of the structural problems. In other words, we have to get voter registration up in key communities in Pennsylvania, and we have to fight and win the absentee ballot fight. You can't win elections if you start down 500,000 votes.
On election day, right?
So that's number one. Two, you got to put forward candidates that can win the primary. And this is tough because we got lots of different parts of our conservative party, our Republican party. But the point I try to make in the book is that we agree on 80% of things. And I try to lay out an agenda, which I think most people could agree on. And we need to get behind a candidate that can win the primary and the general. I'm not speaking just of myself here. I'm speaking of more broadly. It's obviously necessary to win elections to be able to change the direction of the country. And then the third thing is we need to have an agenda. We can't look backwards. People want to know how we're going to fix inflation and fentanyl and the border crisis in China. And we need to lead with a vision. And I'm optimistic about that. The book seems very ominous because of the title and the red on the cover, but it's actually a very optimistic book because I believe this is the American story. We get to the edge of the cliff, we pull ourselves back, and we renew ourselves. And you know, you and I have both lived through that in the past, the dark days of Jimmy Carter and the Reagan Revolution, and I think we can do that again.
Fascinating. So people probably who read the book will learn as you lay out that, and I think this the polls bear this out, you were on the way to winning the primary against Dr. Oz, and then Donald Trump endorsed Dr. Oz, and you tell the story of having gone down there to Mar-a-Lago to try to dissuade the president, and he basically making the argument that you could not win the election unless you said that the 2020 election had been stolen. And when you refused, said you couldn't do that, then he endorsed Dr. Oz. And that probably was the difference.
Well, certainly, you know, when you lose by 900 votes, the fact that the former president, you know, endorsed somebody else and attacked you didn't help. But when you lose by 900 votes, there's lots of things they could have done. So I am responsible. I own the fact I could have won this, and it was very close. But the way that whole thing went down, it was actually very interesting to experience it because when we got to election day, we were close to, you know, tied. It created an automatic recount because it was so close. And so we had 17 days of recount. And through that recount, I experienced the frustrations, the uncertainties, the lack of confidence in our voting process in Pennsylvania. And I think that probably shared elsewhere because I got the Secretary of State, Democrat Secretary of State was telling me there were 30,000 absentee ballots. And it turned out there was less than 10,000. And there were votes that were coming out of Philadelphia that there were 200 ballots lost and they showed up. And there were missing ballots at certain precincts. So I experienced a lot of what people experience during elections and feel not so good about. And in the end, I concluded that I had lost and there was not a path to victory and I stepped up and conceded. But it reinforced to me, even someone who didn't think there was any fraudulent behavior in my election, the challenge we have. And we got to do some basic things like voter ID to give people confidence in our electoral processes. And so I came out of it with a real personal experience of both standing strongly on my belief that 2020 wasn't stolen, but also experiencing what it's like to be in an electoral process when you're close and there's lots of things that don't feel like they're well organized and aligned. And so I have an appreciation for why some people are very upset about it.
Okay, that's also fascinating. So obviously here approaching the end, but I have to ask the question, a book like this with an agenda like this suggests that there could be another campaign in your future. People are talking about the 2024 Senate race against Bob Casey. Is it true you're mulling that?
Yeah, I'm certainly thinking about it. You can't quit your job and throw yourself into running for office and the belief being that the country's heading in the wrong direction. And then if you lose, say, oh, I was just kidding. The motivation doesn't go away. So I've got very much a motivation. I feel an obligation. There's this great William F. Buckley line, which I'm sure you know, Paul, which citizenship is both a privilege to be part of the most exceptional nation in the world, but also a responsibility. So I feel it. I've had public service all my life as a soldier and a public official. And so I'm certainly interested in trying to serve again. Whether running again for the Senate is the best way to do so, we haven't decided yet. We're thinking about that and praying about it. We figure best thing we can do now is try to get the message out, and then the answer will come to us over time.
All right. That's a very cautious answer, but appropriate at this stage of the game. So I want to congratulate you again, David McCormick, on your book, Superpower in Peril, A Battle Plan to Renew America, just out and available. David is making the rounds to promote the ideas, and I wish him the very best. Thank you very much for coming on to Potomac Watch.
Great to talk to you.
Thank you all for listening to Potomac Watch. We're here every day. Catch us tomorrow for another edition of Potomac Watch.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.